You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everyone. This is Robin Johnson, and welcome back to another edition of The Best of Heartland Politics, a radio show I began in 2014 that's now a regular podcast on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. The opioid crisis devastated many families and communities across the heartland of the country. While some of the causes have been identified and addressed, we are still dealing with the fallout, and too many individuals are still susceptible to the lure of opioids. The epidemic became a national issue in the presidential election of 2016. The best book written about the crisis is called Dreamland and was written by author Sam Quinones. The book was written in 2015 and explored the epidemic from a variety of angles. Quinones supplied old-fashioned journalistic foot leather to his approach and brought much-needed clarity and visibility to the issues. It made him very much in demand, and he made numerous appearances in the Midwest during that time, including Iowa and Illinois. I got to interview Sam for my show in 2016 during the presidential race. Here it is. I hope you enjoy my interview with Sam Quinones, author of Dreamland, on the best of Heartland Politics. Good morning and welcome to Talking Politics. This is your host, Robin Johnson. Today, our topic is the opiate epidemic in the United States, especially here in the Heartland. This is a story of more than just addiction and drugs. It's a story that cuts across many foundations of our country, our healthcare system, law enforcement, our system of capitalism, and our culture. And for our purposes, our politics. Our guest today has written an extraordinary book on this topic, and I think it's fair to say he's our foremost expert on this topic in the country right now. His name is Sam Quinones, and the book is called Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic. Sam, thank you very much for taking the time to be on our show today.
It's very nice of you to have me, Robin. I appreciate it.
First of all, we got a lot to get to. I want to talk about the book mainly, and then we'll get into some more current topics, especially the role of this issue in our presidential campaign. But how did your background as a reporter, how did you come to focus on this topic and write this book?
Well, I spent 10 years in Mexico. My focus of my reporting for the last good two decades, really, has been mostly Mexico. So I came to this, I kind of backed into this story. I think most people come to this story concerned about overprescribing of pain pills and addiction to pain pills. And you see that's kind of where most people, police, public health, parents, et cetera, they see that first. I backed into this story by wondering why is it, this was in about 2009, 2010, why is it that Mexican heroin traffickers are doing such good business? I had been in Mexico when the pain pill revolution took place in America. I didn't know anything about Vicodin. I don't know what an OxyContin was, anything like that. I was interested more in why it was that heroin traffickers in Mexico were doing big business, because I'd been a crime reporter off and on for a long time, and I just assumed heroin was like a passe kind of drug. No one used that stuff anymore. And here, not only were people using it, I was finding it in places I talk about in the book, like West Virginia, which I never would have associated with heroin. It's not a state I associated with heroin at all. And so I really got into that and focusing on the town eventually in Mexico, in the small state of Nayarit, the town of Jalisco, where everyone in the town had developed a kind of a business model of selling black tar heroin retail in the United States, in major cities in the United States, as if it were pizza, kind of a delivery model of selling heroin retail, small amounts, tenth of a gram doses. And it was focusing on that town and where they had landed. They had landed, and guys from that one little town, 20,000 people in that town, had landed all across the country. I found them in 20 states, I eventually figured out. And so the big question then was, well, why would they have a market for their heroin at all in places like West Virginia or Kentucky or Tennessee or Idaho or, you know, places like that? And so it was trying to make sense of that I got into this much larger story of the pain revolution in America, that took place in the 1990s, and that led in part, entirely to the heroin epidemic that we have in the country at the moment.
I read this book. This book was so good, I've got to tell you, and my listeners. I was on vacation in Key West, getting up every morning and looking at the ocean. But this book was compelling and distracted my attention from relaxing. It was so good.
Thank you very much.
I recommend it to our listeners. It's really an excellent take. But there's a lot of, as I look back, it seemed like, and I hate to use this trite phrase, but a perfect storm, a confluence of events that occurred that led us to where we are today. One of them is kind of the changes in medical culture, and if you could talk about that, the whole idea of patients, doctors, pharmaceutical companies.
Right, and I believe that that's the case. I don't believe in the bogeyman theory of history where there's one person that you can point, oh, he's the root of our problem. That's not really what's going on here, I don't think. It was a whole bunch of things, societal and economic and cultural, that led us to this. But basically, in the 1990s, there was a revolution in pain management, whereas before that, doctors would never prescribe opiate painkillers, painkillers connected to the opium poppy, basically derived from the opium poppy, like Vicodin, like Oxycontin, or the Percocet, and these kinds of things, for just chronic pain or regular kinds of pain that people could then take these drugs home with them. That was just unthinkable in this country in the 1980s. And a revolution took place. It was sparked first, I think, by pain specialists who believed that we were not using this very, very effective tool to treat people's pain. And in fact, they were right. We were under treating a lot of pain, particularly dying cancer patients were left to be in agony. While these pills would have allowed them a decent last days of life, and these revolutionaries, these pain specialists, began to argue that this was not right, and we need to liberalize the use of these. And of course, one of the things they ran into exactly at the start was a doctor's attitudes. Well, these are addictive medicines, right? And so they began to argue that actually, no, that wasn't true. It wasn't true when used to treat pain, and in many cases it's not. The problem is, in many cases it is, but they kind of overlooked the fact that they really had no evidence to say that the buzz phrase, virtually non-addictive when used to treat pain, or less than 1% of all people who get these use these pills for pain get addicted. They didn't spend a lot of their attitude was, or their goal was, to push the liberal more liberalized use of these pills, and the fact that there really was no evidence to show that these pills were non-addictive for anybody, virtually everyone, when used to treat pain, didn't bother them, I guess, at the time. In time, what happened was pharmaceutical companies picked up on this idea. They began to use these pain specialists as almost like their spokespeople. To a certain degree, they came out with, of course, OxyContin was the big game changer in all this, came out in 96, and they began to promote the prescribing of these pills for all manner of pain in a way that a decade earlier doctors would have never, ever done. And what ends up happening is a kind of a revolution in pain management where we are today, which is that these pills are used for all manner of pain and in massive doses. It's not just that you're given some of these pills after say an acute surgery, say an appendix removal, say, which would be a proper way to use it for 2 or 3 days. Instead, doctors prescribe a month's worth of these pills. Huge amounts of supply was unleashed on the country, all because at the same time, I believe what was happening in the country was that patients were getting more, feeling more entitled, I think, frankly. We as American health consumers felt that we needed, that when we went to a doctor with dementia, we required that doctor fix us, and that we needed them to be totally responsive to our pain needs. And all of that is part of what led to this pain revolution. We wanted an easy, comfortable, uncomplicated life, and these pills were a perfect fit. The problem was, of course, that they were intensely addictive and have been shown to be, even to people who use them, start out using them very much as doctor's order. They can't control the use of these things. And we're giving so much of these drugs to people and having them go home with them, have them use them under their own care, their own supervision. It has been a national catastrophe. And then, of course, at the same time, you've got a transformation in our heroin world, which is to say that in the 1980s, our heroin supply stopped being from the Eastern countries, the Turkey and Burma and Vietnam, and most of our heroin now, virtually all of it comes from either Mexico or Colombia, mostly Mexico nowadays, which means, of course, that it is cheaper, more prevalent, and more potent than ever before. And so you've got people getting addicted to these pills, then eventually not being able to afford them anymore for whatever reason, and they're right there having a perfect transition drug in the form of very cheap, very potent Mexican heroin.
Well, one of the things I noticed, too, that I it makes sense. I lived through it. Everybody did. Was the managed care revolution. The impact that had, where doctors, insurance companies were cracking down, not paying as much. Doctors had to see more patients. Right. And I remember that, where there's not really as much, really deep questioning and analysis of what diagnosis of what causes pain. And this caused just an easy writing a prescription.
And you're absolutely right. With a key thing I came to realize, remember, my background was in Mexican drug trafficking. My big learning curve was in the pain revolution and medical approaches to pain management and that kind of thing. And the key realization for me was that a fundamental issue in this whole question of how this happened was time. Doctors no longer had the time to see a patient, particularly pain patients who are very complicated patients and have complicated issues that need lots of time. You need to spend time to understand all the issues that are going on with the person. And doctors did not have that anymore. By the 1990s, they were primary care physicians were on average seeing their patients had an average of 13 minutes per patient. That is nowhere near enough time to actually deal with the very deep issues and complicated issues that a pain patient comes up with. And so these pills fit that perfectly, though. They were an easy solution, a quick solution. You pull out a prescription pad, and the patient knows, and everybody knows, that the appointment is over. The patient goes away happy because they've got some kind of solution to their problem. All of this is part of that story, that we no longer had the time to deal with a lot of these patients who were very, very complicated. And along with that, you had the belief, the buying into the idea by doctors from coast to coast all across this country, that these pills were now virtually non-addictive when used to treat pain. And therefore, the other crucial point in all this is that there was no maximum dose. There was no limit on how much if 100 milligrams didn't work, well, up it to 200 milligrams. If 200 didn't, well, how about 275? Well, 275, how about 300? It just kept on going. And so you began to see patients on huge amounts of opiates. There are many, many effects of this, but one was it was just unleashing an enormous amount of supply of pills on the country, of opiates on the country. And a lot of those ended up, of course, in the black market.
One number here, Scioto County, is that the way you pronounce it?
Scioto County, right.
10 million pills prescribed in a population of 80,000. 10 million pills. Amazing. At the same time, you had the pharmaceutical industry with new sales techniques that developed. You trace the history of this back to the 50s, right. I believe, that almost made doctors feel like, well, if they didn't prescribe this, they'd be in trouble.
No, that was definitely the case. There was enormous pressure put on doctors to do this. Lawyers for hospitals would say, if you don't treat the patient's pain this way, you can be sued, or we can be sued. There was the idea that pain is now the fifth vital sign. The AMA is just backing off on that idea. But for many, many years, the idea was to push pain treatment by promoting the idea that pain was somehow the fifth vital sign. Of course, it's not a vital sign. You can't measure it. It's not. You die without a pulse. You don't die from pain necessarily. And there was all these other things pushing at the same time. Yes, pharmaceutical companies developed an almost, well, this unprecedented way of promoting for about 6 or 8 years there, of promoting and marketing these drugs. And it starts with Purdue Pharma, which is the company that makes, the privately owned company that makes OxyContin. And they began to promote it as the thing to stick with and stay with, the drug that'll help all your problems with your, we know you doctors have real problems with time. We know you have problems with pain patients who are sucking up all your time. This will take care of your problem. And they began to promote it as if it was an over-counter drug almost. It's an opiate, but it's almost as if it was an over-the-counter drug with, oh, sticky pads and fishing hats, gifts and lunch always, and a CD called Swing in the Right Direction with OxyContin, with a bunch of Count Basie tunes and this kind of thing, trips to Scottsdale for continuing medical education. It was a go-go kind of time, Wild West almost kind of time in drug marketing, and all of this to promote OxyContin, which in my opinion was the total game changer and the reason why we have a heroin problem today.
You're listening to Talking Politics on KBURAM 1490, Burlington, Iowa. Our guest today is Sam Quinones, the author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Compelling book. Finally, this issue gets a little visibility. It was under the radar for a variety of reasons. I think it's very interesting. Part of the reason it became more visible was the death of a famous actor.
Well, yes. I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman was, for your listeners who will remember the AIDS epidemic when it first started, kind of like Rock Hudson in a sense. Although I have to say, one of the things that struck me was that his death did provoke some kind of notice of this problem, but not to the degree that I thought it would. I mean, he's one of our greatest actors. I just love that guy's work. I thought he was so talented and so well known. And his death, I thought, would provoke more. In fact, you know, most of the time when I was writing this book, I thought I was, first of all alone. I thought nobody was going to pay attention to this book. And the reason I thought that was because I was finding it very difficult to get parents to talk about their addicted children or their addicted children who had died. There was so much shame, so much embarrassment, so much stigma surrounding it that nobody wanted to talk about it. And one guy told me, you know, all across the country, there's hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of parents whose response to this has been to kind of go into the bedroom, spend all their time in the dark, their arms around a photo album, crying. But the last thing they want to do is make it public that their kid died, say, with a needle in his arm on a McDonald's bathroom toilet, for example. And I thought because of that silence is why this thing spread, really. Nobody was talking about it. Doctors were prescribing it. They're very influential. They're very trusted. The pharmaceutical companies were promoting this kind of thing as if it was okay to take this stuff now that we now know, science now knows that this was not very addictive for you, et cetera, this kind of thing for people who are in pain. And meanwhile, the parents were completely silent. I'm a longtime reporter, and I know if the parents are going to be silent on a story like this, you're not going to get very much traction at all. It surprised me that that was the case, but I thought that when the book came out, that it would just hit this wall of silence and just fade because no one wanted to recognize this. No one wanted to face up to this national scourge that was going on. And what happened actually is that the opposite happened, and that is that parents now you see far more willing to be public about this, putting it in the obituaries. I know it must be lacerating. It must be torture for parents to do this, but I think it's very healthy, both for them, for their own emotional makeup, but also really for the country. They're doing a good thing for the country when they do that, I think, by saying, look, this is what my son died of. Let's not pretend that it was a heart attack when he was 25. You know, but this is what he died of. And let's confront this. And all you parents out there, be very careful. This kind of thing, I think, is what's been going on in the last year or so. I was surprised that Philip Seymour Hoffman's death didn't do more. But what's happened now is it's become a major issue, a political, social, cultural kind of issue for the entire country, as it should be.
Yeah. And you talk about how perhaps some of this was due to the fact that these weren't kids from the wrong end of the tracks dying. These were football players and cheerleaders. Middle class.
It's totally,
right?
Yes. One of the things, there's a lot of things that are very different about this drug scourge than any that we've had since, say, World War II, for example. One is, for example, that this is the first time a drug epidemic, drug addiction epidemic has been created not by street gangs and street mafias and all that kind of stuff, but by doctors and pharmaceutical companies. And it's a very different kind of thing now that we've got going on here. And it's just, there's a whole bunch of things that are new about this epidemic that we've never faced before. And one of them is that this doesn't seem, heroin was always the denizens of the urban outcast class, the punk rockers and jazz musicians and et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole, goes back quite a long way. This began to affect suburbia, rural America, heartland America, areas like your own, where people who you would not have expected it, who you knew from going to church with them, or that they were your business, they were the son of the guy who owns the business down the street. They were on the football team. And that's because this was that way because it starts with pills. Heroin comes second to this thing. It starts with pills and doctors believing all across the country, in small towns, in big cities, doesn't matter where, that this is a proper way to treat pain. And those pills, the supply of pills just explodes from the mid-1990s to the present. And because of that, that is why we have people getting addicted that we would not have expected would get addicted. As you say, football plays. Football, in my opinion, is almost a gateway to heroin addiction in America today. And why is that? Because so many football players, doctors or team trainers would have believe that you can treat the chronic pain that football creates. You never really get a chance to heal during the season with these pills. And there's many cases, I talk about a few in the book, of football teams, almost entire football teams getting addicted to this, or star quarterbacks or what have you getting addicted. And that's because football creates pain, and pain has been treated with opiate painkillers for the last 20, 25 years.
Well, since this book was published last year, we've just had a continuation of this. It's continuing in the news. The entertainer Prince died, opiate overdose. But what's interesting is in your book, you get into, especially in the final chapter, which I found fascinating, kind of a review of this and where this is going. And of course, politics enters into this, obviously. But what you talk about are some prescriptions that go against the grain from both a liberal and a conservative perspective. One is criminal justice reform, which all of a sudden, maybe because these middle class kids, families are losing their kids, they're pushing some more some solutions, softer solutions on politicians that have traditionally been tough on crime.
Exactly. And that's one of the more interesting things you find to come out of all this. Opiates and heroin addiction are changing Americans in very fundamental ways, it seems to me. And I've been interested to kind of follow how that works. But yes, the people whose kids have been getting addicted or whose families have been affected by this in general are not folks, are usually white, or almost entirely white, I would say. They're from a variety of classes, could be Appalachian low income, could be very wealthy upper class folks in Charlotte, North Carolina. But they probably for many, many years had an idea of what needed to be done with drug addicts, and that's why we have so many prisons in this country. And the problem was that we did not have a balanced approach to drug addiction in this country. It was skewed mightily towards prison building and incarceration and jailing and whatnot, and not towards very much at all towards building out the infrastructure for treatment. And the problem is now a lot of those folks are realizing that. The problem is now we don't have infrastructure for this anymore at all. It's been overwhelmed in most areas. There's long waiting lists. And what happens with heroin addiction is very quickly, opiate and heroin addiction, is that very quickly you find that you tap out all your resources. You don't have money So if it costs a lot of money and rehab costs a lot of money, it's very difficult for you, the street addict now, to get access to it. One of the things that I think is fascinating is it is happening now is a revision of a rethinking of how we do jail. Jail is has always been throw them away a parking lot for people, it also has been a tendency toward a very it's very predatory, it's very tense, very stressful. It's not a place where you build the attitudes of recovery. But in a few areas, a few counties I've found, most of them in Kentucky, people are transforming jail into 24-hour full-time rehab clinics with a completely different philosophy and a different culture. Not one of preying on people, but one of nurturing people. It's complicated. Probably I don't have time to get into all this, how it all works. But I find this to be one of the great revolutionary ideas to come out of this opiate epidemic, very positive ideas. If we can find the one place, if we're not going to arrest our way out of it, as everyone says, we need to have more treatment capacity. Well, where do you find more treatment capacity cheaply and quickly, most importantly? And the one place you can find that in jail is in jail. And that's what a few counties in Kentucky are doing in a very interesting way. But these are very conservative areas. The jailers are not, wide-eyed, radical social experimenters. They are Republican, very, very conservative folks, but they see a need. They roll with facts. They don't let the ideology dominate them. They take the facts and roll with them. And I think that's what's happening. So a place like Kenton County in northern Kentucky is a fascinating place to go see, because I think it's a kind of a paradigm for what should be underway in counties all across this country. And it's the one place. It turns out that jail is the one place, and perhaps even the best place, to find that excess capacity for treatment that we don't have at the moment. And the places where it's happening are in these, what I would consider to be red areas or red states.
You make a statement here. You're very critical of our culture. I think that's fair to say, that's contributed to it. Here's a quote from this book. Heroin is, I believe, the final expression of values we have fostered for 35 years. You also say one of your antidotes to this is community, the sense of community, and that actually heroin is the most important force for positive change in our culture. Can you talk about all that?
Yes, heroin is, well, first of all, I believe in the last 35 years, we have promoted a very isolationist kind of culture here in the United States, where the private sector has been applauded for everything. The government has been scorned and laughed at and ridiculed as inefficient. And we applaud people who devise gimmicks for sending jobs overseas. We applaud them because they got lots of money and the private sector can do no wrong. Well, this is a perfect story of how the private sector created an enormous catastrophe, and all the profits have been recouped by the private sector. The public sector is left to fight this and deal with this. Jails, county hospitals, criminal justice system, on and on and on, ERs, et cetera. And so my feeling is, and also I believe in the last 35 years, we have fostered a culture of consumption as the path to happiness. And more that we buy, the better off we'll be. That's how you make economic measurements of the economy. And it seems to me that we have really adopted this. We have built into our country a very dangerous isolation. You see that in poor communities that are kind of shredded by lack of jobs going overseas. But you also see that in very wealthy communities where suburbs, no one knows each other, the houses, no one's on the street. You go to these streets and there's nobody on the streets. There's nobody in the parks. People are afraid of the public. They're all about bringing everything indoors and inside. Everyone's on a screen. And we have isolated ourselves from each other in a very dangerous way. And it's important to understand that heroin and opiates in general, I just speak of opiates and all kind of the same thing to me, is the most isolating drug. Heroin turns every addict into a narcissistic, self-absorbed, hyper consumer who thinks about buying one thing, the path to happiness lies in one product, buying it over and over and over every day, several times a day. We have isolated ourselves so completely from each other. We have destroyed community in the wealthy suburbs. We have destroyed community in the Rust Belt and farm communities where people are isolated from each other, where property is larger and larger, there are fewer people in the towns anymore. And all of this, I think, in my opinion, is a perfect place for heroin to thrive on all those areas that I've just described. It's a place where a drug that makes everybody isolated, it works perfectly and thrives. It loves its isolation is heroin's natural habitat. I think it's a place and the way to then defeat that is through community. Remember, for a long time and still today, I think it's almost a mania, a manic state in this country where anytime a kid goes outside, parents are freaked. Parents are terrified. Oh my God, what's going to, I spent all my childhood outside. I grew up in Southern California. My mom is from Iowa. She had a farm bell and she every night at 6 o'clock would come out and ring the farm bell. And this was in Southern California and everybody on my street knew whose bell that was for. And we knew, her sons knew, to run home. She wasn't going to go out and look for it because she knew that one place where we're not going to be is inside the house. That we're going to be out running around, riding bikes, playing basketball, skinning our knees, doing all kinds of stuff that boys need to do. And now I go back to that same street, Southern California, beautiful weather. I see nobody on the street, nobody in the parks. Where are they? Most kids are in their bedrooms. The irony is, the tragic irony of this is that it's in those places, the hallmark of this epidemic, the place where it's taken place is the private bedroom. Crack had the crack house, the very public house where everyone just kind of took it over and it became a kind of a place for every crack user around to get high. The heroin epidemic, the opioid epidemic has the private bedroom. That's where kids are in those same private bedrooms where parents thought they were most safe and they were most away from the public sphere that was so, for some reason, dangerous to a lot of parents. It's in those private bedrooms where kids are hiding their dope, where they're shooting up, and that's where they're dying oftentimes. And all of this is a part of, I think, what we become as Americans, and that was what I realized the book was about as I was pretty far into it.
Yeah, we're a little over, but I got to hit on one more topic, and that brings us to the presidential campaign. I remember reading about how candidates campaigning in Iowa and New Hampshire were surprised because of the number of people, parents, coming and talking about this issue. Ironically, John Kasich, he comes out of your book as perhaps one of the good guys. He was doing some good things in Ohio by expanding Medicaid to provide insurance to provide assistance, recovery, rehab for a lot of these addicts. You got a chance to talk to Hillary Clinton a little about this. Maybe talk about that a little. You said in the book you hope this became a bigger issue, but are the Clintons kind of emblematic of the excesses of the 90s that you talk about?
maybe they are. I didn't talk to Hillary Clinton. I spoke with her campaign advisor. Okay. But it was that same thing that you that was the first sign to me. This was 3 weeks after the book came out that maybe this issue was not going to be silent anymore. I assumed that it would be. I assumed that I'd have a terrible time promoting the book and getting interest in the book. And that, the first sign maybe that was not going to be the case was when that campaign advisor called me a few weeks after the book was published. But perhaps they are. It's an interesting thought. I hadn't considered it. I think though that this issue should have been a bigger one. Should be a bigger one in the campaign. In part, it's because this is a very different and very weird political year, and there's a whole lot of other things going on.
Just a final question for you real quick. Does the fact that immigration, the role immigration plays in this, if somebody reading this puts it down, would they come away thinking, you know, Trump's right, we need to build the wall, we need to regulate immigration more strictly?
Yeah, these are bigger questions you're asking. It's possible. On the other hand, you know, keep in mind, this does not start because of Mexican heroin traffickers. This starts has nothing to do. If there were no pills, these guys would be doing no business in heroin today. It just doesn't start because of that. It's also important to understand that building a wall, which is the one policy prescription that I know Donald Trump for, will have almost no effect on heroin, because heroin is very easy to smuggle in small amounts. We do have free trade with Mexico, and unless you want to wall off free trade, which would be devastating, I think, to the country, in many areas anyway, that you would and kind of become like almost like North Korea in some sense, you would have a very difficult time of cutting back on that. However, and this is where I believe, spent a lot of time in Mexico, that we need a much deeper relationship with Mexico, and this is where the wall becomes the real problem, because it hinders our ability to talk with Mexico, to develop the ties with Mexico, because Mexico needs to change. I lived there 10 years. I wrote two books about it. We need a modern criminal justice partner, for example, in Mexico. We don't have one, and that's, there's no reason why we shouldn't. They shouldn't be that way, but they need push. The problem is, when you propose a wall like this in this very, very gruff and abusive almost terms, you turn off any ability to do that. And what you end up doing really is inviting a much more severe problem than you already have. It seems to me that the way to deal with Mexico is as a firm partner. It's you speak firmly, bluntly to Mexico, but also as a partner, and not go out of your way to insult people in Mexico, because after all, they are too. It's important to understand. We have, through conscious decision or not, made Mexicans our working class in this country. They are the people who cut up our beef and clean our pools and build our houses and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so there is this economic benefit to Mexicans in the United States, for some people anyway. But it seems to me that the whole wall idea is just bluster. There may very well be a reason to review and strengthen immigration laws. That's another issue. But as this current campaign develops, I'm just disappointed that the way we attempt to deal with this is by this very, it's almost a narcotic in itself. Oh, great, we're going to build a wall and all our problems will be solved. That's almost like a narcotic. It's a way of saying, I have one answer to all your problems. Well, that was what the pain pills were about. And certainly heroin has that influence on people. Oh, I take heroin and all my problems will go away. That's the wall to me.
Okay, before we conclude, just there is a local angle on this. I did some calls and some research around with local law enforcement, political officials. There is Southeast Iowa has a heroin initiative that is on Facebook for people that are interested in more information. I spoke with the Burlington Police Department. There is a rising awareness of this issue. There was a summit at the University of Iowa either last year or early this year, growing recognition in the state of Iowa about this issue as well, and across the river in Illinois. In fact, Sam's book is used by local law enforcement to help in training. So this is an important book. And Sam, you have a website you want to share for people that are more interested?
My website is samquinones.com, just my name, .com. I'm also on Facebook. I appreciate people following me. If they like, it's Sam Quinones 7, and you can find out all you need to know about me and stuff like that at those two sites.
Quinones is Quinones, and you will be in Iowa a little later this year, right?
I'll be in October, and I'll be in Peoria in August, which is an amazing thing to me, I think. Peoria, for all it stands for in our culture, that it would have a heroin problem probably says as much as you need to know.
That's where the book was recommended to me from the state's attorney in Peoria County. So,
there you go.
Sam Quinones, author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, thank you very much for this interview and for sharing this information and for your work. I think it's very important, again, not just as a drug question, but for some larger issues facing our country.
Robin, it's been great talking with you. Thanks so much.